Well, if you lost the mother after, if it was an obvious direct result of mm-hmm. what you had done in terms of, okay. So, and I was, you know, really very ill. I suffered what's known as an acute dilatation of the stomach, so that, but I didn't know I had a baby, you know, because I was bigger afterwards than I was before. Mm-hmm. I was having, I continued to have what I apparently thought was labor pains. Of course, the baby was here, but they didn't do very much about him, so that he was very lethargic. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody decided that they had to do something about him, so they brought him in to me. Also, they thought that might help me. And this I remember quite vividly. You know, I realized then for the first time that I had a baby, and my milk had not come in, and suddenly it came. Okay. So we put him to breast. And now you have to remember that I am a nurse, and I was well trained, so I knew exactly what to do to make him nurse. He wouldn't. And I couldn't get anybody to listen to me that was wrong. They took him away once, they took him away twice. The third time I had hysterics. Mm-hmm. I must have raised all hell, and I really must have, you know. And of course, what had happened is that he was lethargic because they really had not done very much with him, okay. Once they put him to breast, of course, I was on a lot of medication. Mm-hmm. He was busy getting the medication,
right?
So he was showing even more lethargy. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, well, of course, they were right. You see, there really wasn't a viable child here, because look what he was doing. You see. Well, when I raised such hell, and I, you know, and there was just no, I remember this now. Maybe I remember it as being more than I did, but I doubt it. I wouldn't give him up. I wouldn't stop crying. I wouldn't stop yelling. Mm-hmm. So they got a pediatrician in. They got my doctor in. They got, you know, mm-hmm. resident in, and I said, and I can close my eyes and remember in my mind's ear, is he getting my medication? And everybody stopped and said, it's possible. Oh. And so I came off medication, and that was a mess, because I was still a pretty sick cookie, but I would have no medication, and I did put him to breast, and I did get him to drink, you know, to mm-hmm. and he began to, and of course he's quite a guy. So that's how we began.
How long did you stay in the hospital?
I think I was in the hospital almost 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And your son stayed with you in the hospital?
At that time, my son stayed with me, and then my husband and a friend carried us upstairs
when he came home.
I guess it must have been not quite 3 weeks, because then we had a pit in the van.
Mm-hmm.
And but he was pretty sick for me.
Mm-hmm. When
he came home with impetigo. He came home and he, as I told you, he had a hernia, mm-hmm. which had to be dressed and so on. And there I was, you know. It was a beauty.
So you needed to stay in bed at that time?
I didn't stay in bed. Who had money for nurses? My husband did as much as he could.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had and still have a very dear friend who is my adopted sister. She and her family pretty well adopted us. And she and her husband were his godfather and godmother. She was around. She's a nurse, too. She was around. And ultimately, as things got worse instead of better, one of my sisters came for a little while, and the other sister came. We managed.
When you say worse, that means that you became ill?
I told you that they had unfortunately unseated, we didn't know this, but they had unfortunately unseated my, well, I didn't, I hate to burden you with this, but you're asking. What they did was not complete the delivery.
Mm-hmm.
even though it was a cesarean. That accounted for what was happening to me. Okay, when they discovered that they didn't have a, they only had a small piece of a placenta, they realized what was going on. Okay, well then they had to come and get this. Except that they were afraid. And you have to remember, this is quite a few years back.
And they didn't have sonogram and all that good stuff.
To move me to the operating room, so they thought I was. Comatose anyway. Mm-hmm. So they decided to come to the room and do it in the room.
In your apartment?
No, no.
Oh,
hospital.
Hospital. Hospital.
So they did. The only thing is I was awake. And I did know what was happening.
No anesthesia?
And no, that's right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple of, what in my memory, you know, burly interns, but they probably weren't, you know, but in my mind, this is they simply sat on the bed and put me in, you know, stirrup position by holding me, and they completed it. But unfortunately, I was rigid. I was not comatose. I was aware. And so they tore my kidneys out of place. They did a lot of damage. And they hurt my back. And the net result, I mean, we knew none of this. We were just very grateful that I was alive and that I had a baby to take home, and we went on, but slowly but surely, I, you know, kept getting sicker and sicker, and I thought, you know, that I was mental, I thought all kinds of things. You know, when you're a nurse, you question yourself in a peculiar way. Well, it wasn't that at all, it was that I had been badly hurt, and I ultimately was, you know, when I got into a very serious situation, so that I was in bed for about 9 months, and then we did have to have help, a variety of different help. And on a positive level on that score, among the people that we got a variety of people, not nurses. Public health nurses would come in a couple of times a week and, you know, help the baby and so forth. I simply
and that
did
was
not.
Available through the city or county?
The county,
health?
Right.
I see. And you knew about that? Or did your doctor?
Well, actually, the doctor did.
Uh-huh.
But in actual fact, to get me up, Paul simply wrapped me in tight sheets and taught me to, you know, put my feet on his feet and
to walk.
Yeah. It was, and that's how, you know, ultimately getting me up meant putting me in a very heavy brace with shoulder straps and stuff. It didn't matter. I was up.
Mm-hmm.
And from bed, we, you know, I handled Howard to best, and by then he was running around, you know. And he was an amazing child with all of this going on, so that when the public health, I remember one particular time when a strange public health nurse came in. And she had been told that, you know, there was a bedridden patient, and this little one came to the door, and she said, "Is your grandmother in?" And he said, "No, my mother is in bed, and I'll show you where she is." And he did, and she said, "Ask me, you know, how will I find this, how will I find that?" And Howard piped up and said, "I will show you." He did. And, you know, he was really, he was quite a youngster, although he had his own problems, which we took care of, you know, he had some pretty nasty allergies and so forth. So that's, you know.
How long was it before you felt that you were capable of getting up and taking care of things? It sounds like it was a year, maybe even two.
Oh, well, you see, it was, well, once I was walking, that was fine, except that many other things happened to me, and I don't really want to give you, except to say that at one point in our lives, when Howard was 8 years old, and we were doing reasonably well, let's see, Paul, I think, how did it go? I think Paul got a cold. Howard got mono. And I, you know, was taken care of both of them. And I got the same virus, or a virus, which affected a major artery, which died in when they went to, well, mm-hmm. I'm jumping. I got sick, and my arm seemed to get weak, and then very swollen, and then what appeared to be paralysis. It was an ugly color. Nobody could figure out what was wrong with me. At the same time that I had Howard in bed because he had a very nasty mono. Paul, I'd gotten up already. Mm-hmm. Well, ultimately, nothing would do but that I went to the hospital. I simply said that they'd either take care of me if I went to the hospital or if I'd find other people. So I went to the hospital. By then I had gotten Howard far enough along in his illness so that he was up and about, although limited. And at that point, Lucy would pick him up from school. Mm-hmm. I went to the hospital, and all sorts of people saw me, and, you know, they thought I had an extra rib, they thought I had a bad... They thought all kinds mm-hmm. of things. And what it turned out to be was the right subclavian artery, which had been hit by the virus. And when the surgery took place and they exposed it, it crumpled and fell apart. So that what it turned out to be is that I was, you know, very close to death before, very, very close to death during, and then I made it, you know, I came back. But it took...
Do you meow and purr?
Anyway, the point is that it took a long time to rehabilitate me, my arm. I have a perfectly good arm, but when I still see the surgeon, Dr. William Watson, and when he sees me, he takes a look and he says, part of that's mine, part of that's mine.
So that took 8 years after you're talking.
Well, this was a totally different.
Separate.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. I was just getting along, getting there, right. When wham.
Something else happened.
Well, it was that, it's been that kind of bit. But, this is crazy, this is taking far too long. Anyway, to jump. For a long time, I was more or less housebound, mm-hmm. and it was all I could do to maintain the household.
Were you still living in Oakland? On Oakland Avenue?
When Howard was 13, we bought the house on Beechwood Boulevard.
So you went from Oakland Avenue to Beechwood?
No, we went from Oakland Avenue, which was on the third floor and had only one bedroom, to Beeler Street. The first floor of a duplex,
okay.
which had two bedrooms. And then from there, in the meantime, Paul had gone from the Bureau of Mines to Westinghouse.
When did he switch?
In 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in 53, 54,
mm-hmm.
that we bought the house.
Mm-hmm.
And
had you been involved in a synagogue throughout all this, or gotten support of any kind of community?
No, we didn't really have. We had wonderful support as far as friends were concerned, mm-hmm. and I've left out a very, very important part of our lives. I don't know how to compress this.
You're doing
just
fine.
Tell it.
You're doing fine.
When
whatever comes to mind.
When Howard was trying to be born,
mm-hmm.
I went into labor, and this was on a Wednesday. And I went to the hospital. Well, I actually went into labor early in the morning. I talked to the doctor, and he at first said it was false labor. We waited, you know, we ultimately got to the hospital. Okay. And I stayed in labor. And they kept saying, including people he brought in, you know, that this was not when I went into labor and had baby like that, you know, mm-hmm. no problem. In the meantime, I was in labor. Again, unfortunately, which is what makes me so upset when we talk about it, I called the shots because the doctor, the chief, came in on a Friday, late morning, and he said, you relax. I went, you know, you're not in labor. And I said, put your hand on my belly and then tell me that. Put my hand, his hand on my belly, and we walked out, and the next thing I knew, I was shaving for the cesarean. But that, in the meantime, I told you that Reba and Joe Swartz are his godparents. Mm-hmm. Reba and Joe and Paul and I became friends before they were married. They were married the spring after we were. No, a year and a half after we were. Unfortunately, Joe's gone now. And how we became familiar to know them, now they're native Pittsburghers. Paul's roommate was dating Joe Swartz's sister.
That's a very small world.
And that's how, you know, they just opened their arms and took us in. But Bessie Littman, this is Reba's mother, was simply one of the most wonderful women I have ever known in all my life. Now, I told you that my mother died when I was 13. Mm-hmm. She was just marvelous. Mm-hmm. When I suddenly was faced with the cesarean, my husband was called, mm-hmm. because he had to give them permission. They felt that I was too ill, and so forth. Whatever. He told Reva, or Reva had called the hospital. Somehow she knew. She told her mother. And her mother, this was a Friday, her mother was making Shabbos. She was in a house dress and in an apron. I never saw this, but she came running to the hospital. And when she came to the hospital, they said, Grandma, where are you going? And she was my son's grandmother and still is thought of as my son's grandmother. She acted that way. She treated him that way. She treated us that way. And when he was married, she was part of the chuppah. She was part of the reception line. She was his grandmother from the day he was born. For her 70th birthday, the children got together and had made a grandma pin. Mm-hmm. We were part of that. He is on that grandma mm-hmm. pin, which we buried with her. But the point is that that's how lucky we were. That's how marvelous people can be.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
So anyway, this, you know, we had lots of nastinesses in our lives and lots of good things in our lives despite mm-hmm. the nastinesses. And along about 1959, 58, 59, through one of my other friends, I joined the League of Women Voters. I was very shy, I must admit. I was very shy for a long time about getting out. What I didn't realize is that part of that was that we were up on a terrace, and it was difficult for me to get up and down, and I would get very tired, so I would be shy of telling people this, and I can't bend, and I was shy of that, you know. I was just, I suppose one of the things, and it's a stupid thing, but I do know that both doctors and nurses suffer from it, you feel guilty. Somehow I should have been able to prevent this. Well, it took me a long time to get past that. However, one of my very good friends persuaded me to come along. She drives. I don't. I never had the chance to learn. To come along to a meeting, and I did, and I became active with the League within my own limits. And from 60 or 61 up until we moved here, I was what I used to call the alternate telephone. The League. My number appeared in the book, and I answered the phone. We do have a downtown office, uh-huh. and at that time it was only manned part of the week. And I answered the phone the rest of the time.
The office is in Kaufman's department?
Not anymore.
Oh, now
it's in the YW.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
but it was in Kaufman's for many, many years, you're quite correct. And gradually I found that relief was tremendously stimulating. And
what kind of things did you do? Or did you start out doing and then?
Well, the first thing that I was asked to do, and again, I was working with somebody who did drive, so it was possible to do what had to be done. Most of it I did from home, from the telephone, and that was to handle the annual meeting, which at that time, it isn't so now, but at that time meant getting the setup, you know, the whole business for about 110 members. That was the first chore, real chore that I undertook. The second one, and it was ongoing, as I say, until we came here, was the telephone. And then I did work on a couple of tax studies, the fair housing, the schools, various problems relating to the schools. And then in the late 60s, we undertook an update of housing position. And I did agree to chair that.
Why don't you tell me a little bit more about that?
All right. We had had some very extensive discussions on, through the years, housing looms quite large, as you might imagine, in a city like this. And our first major position was, as I said, the fair housing. And that was a question of non-discrimination. And it exists to this day. It was one of the first and a good piece of legislation. The particular discussions that we had prior to where I came into the act in terms of acting as a chairman were a question of subsidized housing and having communities that were not segregated. And this overlapped to the segregation or the problem of segregation in the schools. We had come to consensus without question that segregated communities was a bad approach to living and a wrong approach to living. And among the things that we had done was come up with the idea In 1968, the city of Pittsburgh had established a special housing court as a result of some real activity and agitation against slum housing. And this was, we had studied how it worked and we felt that it was very good. And there was a housing clinic associated with it. We felt further that another type of housing clinic might be of very real worth to prevent dislocation of particularly our senior citizens. That is, if somebody lost a roof or lost a furnace or if the plumbing went bad, this kind of thing. Not everybody knows where to turn, number one. Number two, not everybody knows where to get money, if you can get money. And if you lose the unit, what do you do? Where do you go now?
Right.
And particularly, and I was a lot younger then, I was very aware that, related to my own studies, I guess, but I was very aware that if you dislocate, I'm not saying relocate, but dislocate, the relocation is necessary, but when you pick up an older person and precipitously move them, even if you move them into something that's far better than you're leaving, mm-hmm. you have indeed dislocated that life, and you don't always manage to make that person comfortable or able to go on living in quite the same way. You frequently reduce the length of worthwhile life. Mm-hmm. So we had come to the idea that maybe if there was an emergency repair clinic, we called it clinic, but it would be program, that might be of tremendous worth. Well, it seemed kind of exciting to see if we could go downtown and sell the idea. Well, again, I have to remind you that I don't drive, but I have friends who do. So a very good friend of mine, actually a Quaker, said, hey, you know what? If you want to do it, I'll drive and I'll be with you. I'll be your buddy, but you do the talking.
Mm-hmm. Who was that?
Dorothy Bauer.
I guess I don't know her. I knew some people.
She's a great gal, and we're friends, and we still are buddies. Anyway, down we went, and we interviewed a variety of people.
Who did you talk to?
We interviewed the judge of the court, and we interviewed the executive director of the court, the administrative director of the court.
Do you remember who the judge was?
Yeah, he was very new, mm-hmm. as new as we were, mm-hmm. And that was Judge Pinkauer.
Oh, Alan Pinkauer.
Alan Pinkauer, who became a good friend of mine. Now, by then, it was we had come to consensus on vigorous enforcement of codes to maintain or upgrade low and low moderate cost housing at the minimum code standard, which meant that they would be standard mm-hmm. units. Mm-hmm. Well, that was part of what we were going to see if we could implement. At the moment, I'm losing all the other. There were several other particular points that we were going to make, but down we went. And I guess this must have been early in the spring of 70. Well, we showed up, and it was just at the time when the Pittsburgh Advisory Committee on Housing and Community Development, which became my baby, was forming as such. There had been, up until that point, essentially the same group, but under the name of the Mayor's Committee on Housing and Community. The Mayor's Committee on Housing, that's what it was. The decision had been reached, not by me, because we were not part of this, that they wanted to move to the next step of community action, and instead of having a mayor's committee, they wanted the Pittsburgh committee, which would be far more independent. Mm-hmm. But it was a committee of very peculiar nature. It was made up, it's an umbrella organization, even today, and it was made up of interested citizens, representatives from community groups, from neighborhood groups, as well as people in the housing field. And that meant administrative people on the city, county, state, federal level, private, quasi-private, everybody interested in housing. Okay. The open meeting was it's a very loose organization, and the open meeting was chaired by what was then the housing coordinator of the city of Pittsburgh. Now, at that point, the city did not have a housing department.
Who was the housing coordinator at that time?
And that was David O'Loughlin. He is still in the city. He left the administration way back, but he actually is an architect. and he was the coordinator. At that point, when we came in, I suppose I should be saying I by now.
Yes, right.
When I came into the picture, the interest in housing was primarily in terms of what another person I work with called bricks and mortar.
Okay. Can I stop you right there, Mrs. Cohen?
Sure.